Hello, listeners of Channel 88.1 FM, KFHC Ponca Sioux City, and KOIA Storm Lake. Hey, we are so glad you set your dials to that radio station. We are also glad that perhaps you are listening Monday at 9 a.m. or Saturday at 7 p.m., or maybe you went to our website, SiouxlandCatholicRadio.com, and clicked on this show, which is Faith in Action, or perhaps you are listening on one of our podcasting platforms. Spotify is probably the one we get the most traffic on. And again, you just click on Faith in Action. I'm your host for the show, Joanne Fox, and as I've said before, I'm always just very affirmed that you listeners are taking time to hear the program. I think we bring a lot of interesting guests and information to you, and for that we are all very grateful here at Siouxland Catholic Radio. But at the top of our gratitude list is the sponsor for this program, Mary's Choice. It is a pregnancy resource center here in Sioux City, Iowa, and they have been longtime supporters, and we are so grateful because their support enables us to be on the podcasting platforms. So a big shout out to our good friends at Mary's Choice. And listeners, we hope you support them as well. Well, as you well know, if you listen to this show at all, I tend to bring on my friends to talk about events or things that I find interesting. And this is going to be a new friend of mine that I am going to be on the phone with. And I'll give you a little backstory about this. If you happen to follow me on Facebook, every Monday, my good friend Teresa Jackson and I go on our excellent Monday adventures. And we made this kind of something we wanted to do a couple years ago because we realized, even though we were both kind of natives of Northwest Iowa, that we really had no idea of what was going on in some of our communities or the things to visit or even Northeast Nebraska or Southeast South Dakota. So close, you know, within an hour and a half, so many wonderful things to see. Now, we are sharp women, so we Googled things to do in Iowa, things to do in Nebraska, things to do in South Dakota, and then we started to narrow our searches down into specific communities or cities. And one day, on a whim, I Googled things to do in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And of course, there's many, many wonderful things to do. Many of them we had already done. But to my astonishment, one of the things that came up was to visit Augustana College. And there, the Center for Western Studies. And both Teresa and I are kind of history nuts. And so we really like going places that have historical information. We really love pulling off the road and reading historical markers, which never puts us at risk, listeners. You know, we're always very cognizant of pulling all the way off to the road. And then I take pictures, or Teresa takes pictures, and then we post them and talk about our excellent Monday adventures. So we're up in Sioux Falls, and we wander over to Augustana College, beautiful campus, by the way. Here is the Center for Western Studies. And so we're reading about all this information. And to my astonishment, here are two displays about two priests I have never heard of, Father Ambrose Mattingly and Father Stan Maudlin. And their story and backstory was so fascinating to me that when I came back to Sioux City, I made notes and I said to myself, this would be a great Faith in Action to alert the listeners about this gem that, listeners, is free, that you can just go in and see, in addition to information about Father Ambrose and Father Stan. There's a lot of other stuff there, too, as well. But I think right practically in our own backyards, and as I've said on this program time and time again, we have many listeners in Southeast South Dakota, Northeast Nebraska, Northwest Iowa. And a lot of times we do focus on Northwest Iowa because that's where the studio is, and it's kind of a comfort level with us. But I'm going to push us beyond our comfort level today. So after I made all my notes, I thought, well, now how do I find out more about this? So again, I went to my email and emailed Augustana College and the Center for Western Studies and discovered that on staff was an individual who could talk to me about this collection. So on the phone with me from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, is Elizabeth Cesar. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? Are you a South Dakota girl or North Dakota or Iowa or Nebraska? Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
You're so close, but okay. Not quite. So I grew up near Albert Lea, Minnesota, between two small towns named Walters and Keister. And how I became a South Dakotan is I came to Sioux Falls to attend Augustana College. At the time, it was Augustana College, now Augustana University. I majored in history, and I actually completed an internship at the Center for Western Studies while I was a student. I graduated in 2006, and after graduation, I went to work at the Barnes & Noble here in Sioux Falls for 5 years, which is where I met my husband. And then in 2011, there was some restructuring of the positions at the Center for Western Studies, and I was able to come back as the full-time collections assistant.
Okay, so that is your title, collections assistant.
Yes.
Okay. Now, again, of course, listeners are so familiar with Briarcliff University, which is practically in our backyard. It is literally down the street from us, our studios. But they may not be familiar with Augustana University. And you did segue into, it used to be a college. In the good old days when I was growing up, that's what it was called. And so let the listeners know a little bit about Augustana and its history.
Sure. So Augustana is a private ELCA Lutheran-affiliated university here in Sioux Falls, but it hasn't actually always been located in Sioux Falls. Augustana was originally founded in 1860 in Chicago, Illinois.
Ah, now see, I did not know that, and I'm a Sioux City native, and all you got to do is go to Facebook to see how old I am. So I'm 70 years old. So, yeah, I did not know that.
Yeah, there was a decision to move west and follow the Norwegian immigration westward. And interestingly enough, there is a sister school, Augustana College, in Rock Island, Illinois. We actually started together. And then there was this split between the Swedes and the Norwegians, and we, the Norwegians, took off.
Okay, the Swedes, I love it. Okay, so you took off.
University, so there's less confusion now, but we did originally start together. And in fact, our school has earned the nickname the College on Wheels from historians because of how often we moved in this westward migration. There were stops in Paxton, Illinois, in Marshall, Wisconsin, Beloit, Iowa, Canton, South Dakota, before we finally arrived in Sioux Falls in 1918 and came to the city to merge with another school that was here called Lutheran Normal School.
Okay.
Today, Augustana serves about 2,100 students, and we are guided by our five core values, which are Christian, liberal arts, excellence, community, and service.
Oh, very good. I mean, that's certainly high things to strive for at any institution. I guess I was kind of curious, you may or may not know the answer to this, but the name Augustana, and I've heard that name associated with other churches, but I guess I never put two and two together as to what that might mean.
I believe it's tied to the Augsburg Confession.
Okay, then that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. And you said about how many students do you have right now?
2,100.
Okay. And the segue from college to university, I know a lot of times that happens when an institution will implement master's degrees in certain areas. And so how did that transition for Augustana?
I don't know the specifics, but I know that they were already in the process of implementing master's programs on campus and building more of them. They're also introducing doctoral programs. And so there was a feeling that the change to university was warranted because of kind of how our structure had been evolving.
And I imagine students from all over, probably the United States, maybe even all over the world.
Yes, yes. Yeah, we have one of our largest classes of international students this year. Yep.
Oh, very good. Who doesn't like the whole international idea? You know, we are all kind of one under God's umbrella there.
Yes.
So let's get down to the specifics then, because I stumbled across this Center for Western Studies. I had no idea it was on the campus. And again, I was blown away. And so how about some history about the Center for Western Studies?
Sure. So we were originally conceptualized in 1964 by a man named Herbert Krauss, who was an English professor on campus and was also Augustana's first writer in residence. And in 1970, we were formally established by the Augustana Board of Regents. And we are a program of the university focused on improving the quality of social and cultural life in the Northern Plains region and achieving a better understanding of our region and its place in the greater American West. And so a lot of everything we do is tied to this Northern Plains focus, which for us, to put that in state boundary terms, is South Dakota and the immediately surrounding states.
Okay, and that would include Nebraska and Iowa, where our listeners are.
Yes, absolutely. And all of our programming is tied to that focus. And it's funny, I've been here 11 years, and I still don't have, like, a one- or two-word phrase that describes what we are, because we are so many different things all at the same time. So you've already kind of alluded to some of our programming. We are a museum. We have historical exhibits on display. We're open to the public to come visit. We are also an art gallery, and we do 3 to 4 art exhibitions every single year, and a lot of that artwork's available for sale from the artists. We have our own library of research materials, and we also have the archives. We also are a book publisher, and we publish about one book a year, but we're a major academic press in the state of South Dakota. And in addition to all of that, which is kind of our regular programming, we also do events that we sponsor on campus. Our biggest one by far is the Beau Forum on Public Affairs, which is an annual lecture series featuring national or international speakers. We also, every April, do a 2-day academic conference called the Dakota Conference, where we welcome up to 70 to 80 speakers to come and speak on a particular topic of our choosing. The theme changes every year, but that's a chance for us to look at contemporary topics, but in their historical context. So, for instance, this will interest you. Our event this past April was focused on radio and the history and impact of radio communications in our region.
It would interest me.
This coming April, the theme is going to be the Outlaw Plains, however people want to interpret what it means to be an outlaw.
Okay.
And our other big event of the year is called Artists of the Plains. It is a weekend-long art show that we host off-site, and it's actually coming up, so I want to mention it to everyone. It's coming up October 28th to 30th, and it'll be held at the Hilton Garden Inn in downtown Sioux Falls. It's completely free. We have more than 24 artists coming to show their work over the course of that weekend, so that's the next big one that's coming up. But then we'll do lots of other events throughout the year, too, author events, other kinds of talks and presentations.
And then the Forum on Public Affairs, typically when is that held?
Different times of year, depending on the speaker's schedule. We are expecting a spring event this year. So spring 23 is what we're hoping for.
Okay. And any idea who that speaker might be? We would then be on the edge of letting everybody know before it's publicized.
We're we're in conversations, but we don't have anything official yet.
Okay, fine and dandy. And I remember, you know, seeing some information up on the walls about that. And
yes.
Who are some of the previous people? I didn't make notes about who those individuals were, but I do remember I was impressed. So maybe you could, Liz, tell the listeners about some previous speakers.
Yes. Yeah, so the forums started in the, I want to say, mid-90s, I think is the right time frame. And some of our first speakers were General Colin Powell.
Well, that's a big name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Did you say Mikhail Gorbachev?
Mikhail Gorbachev, yes.
Oh, my heavens to Betsy.
Yes, yes. We had Sandra Day O'Connor. We had Madeleine Albright come and speak. We had both President George and Barbara Bush.
Wow.
And some of the more recent ones that have been really big draws, we've had Condoleezza Rice. We had a twofer event with Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein not too long ago. Neil deGrasse Tyson came, who is a very big deal astrophysicist. He's very much in the public eye. So yeah, we've had a very wide variety of speakers, but very high level personas.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, and so listeners, you might want to mark your calendars when you get your 2023 calendars and mark spring event at the Center for Western Studies, because I'm sure that will be publicized. And, you know, or you can always Google Augustana University Center for Western Studies. And then I would think on your website that you would publicize that event. Now, I guess that would be a question. Is there a cost to attend that event then?
I was going to get to that. Yes, I was going to mention that as you were talking. It is a free event. That is the beauty of what Governor Niels Bohr and his sisters did in establishing the endowment that funds that event, is they've created this high-profile event that is completely free for the public to attend.
God bless them. What a great way to plan your estate and then have that available for the general public. I mean, I can't think of anything more, I don't know, I can't even, altruistic, I guess, is the word that came to my mind first, and I think that might be right, to do something like that. But what a testament to Herbert Krauss, because I was going to ask you, Liz, how is the Center for Western Studies funded then? I mean, I understand how it's funded, you know, as far as this, the Forum on Public Affairs is, but how is the entire Center study, Western Studies funded?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good question. Because the assumption in a lot of cases would be that the university funds our programming, which is actually untrue in our case. We are funded kind of three ways. One is through endowment. Our program's own endowments, like the Bohr Endowment, that funds that particular program. We're also funded by gifts from donors. We have our programming fees, like the Dakota Conference. There is a fee for the Dakota Conference to attend. And then also we're funded through membership, like you would have a membership in any other museum, and you get some, you know, perks for being a supporter of the museum. We have a membership program like that that also is very important to our annual funding.
Okay, well, that makes sense, because absolutely you need to maintain the items that are associated with the Center for Western Studies. You have staff that needs to be paid. The place needs to be upkept. You know, maybe the windows need to be cleaned or the plants need to be watered or something like that. So, yeah, there are expenses involved. And again, listeners, since I've been there, like I said, I was just blown away. It is an absolutely gorgeous facility. So, Liz, we've kind of talked about the Center for Western Studies and some of the wonderful things they do. But, of course, what really resonated with me as I was standing there reading about Father Ambrose Mattingly was this priest that had so much to do with what you referred to as the Northern Plains. Never heard of him, had no idea he was anybody, and was just wowed by just a little bit of backstory I read on, it was this big panel. So, Liz, why don't you tell the listeners why in the world you have Father Ambrose Mattingly as part of the display?
Sure. Would you like me to start with a little bit more background about kind of the archives in general, or do you want me to jump right into...
Yeah, okay. Let's do the archives in general first.
Okay, yeah, kind of segues into it. So, so as the collections assistant, I take care of the research collections at the Center for Western Studies. So the collections of the stuff that they've been gathering over these, 50-plus years. And I, my work is kind of threefold. I work with donors to determine what kinds of items we will accept into the collections, and I do that legal transfer of the property into our care. And then I supervise a staff of student interns who help with processing the collections, which is jargon in my field. Basically what it means is that we organize those materials that have come in, we rehouse them so that they're going to be kind of like ready for longer-term storage and preservation, and we label all of that, and then we catalog all of the information about the collection into a computer database that we use to manage the collections. And then the third part of it, after the collections are ready to be used, is that we then also assist any and all researchers who want to access those materials. And that can be remote access or on-site visits. It can be individuals. It can be entire classrooms coming in. And it also includes digitization. So the ability to scan certain materials and put them online so that they're even more readily accessible to the public for work. And I perform this work across all of the center's research collections. So we've mentioned that we have archives. We also have our own collections of fine and ethnographic art. We have artifacts. And then I also co-manage our Krauss Library with the staff of the campus library, the Mickelson Library. But that's kind of the broad overview of my whole job. I spend the most of my time working with the archives because that tends to be where the most people are coming to us with questions and yeah. wanting to access them for their scholarly projects. So in the archives, we have about 4,500 linear feet of materials, which again, that's a term that we use in my field. It's a little harder to like wrap your head around. When I bring students through, I tell them I've done the math. And we can't know for sure, but based on that number of boxes, we easily have 7 million pages of documents in the archives, and I would say easily 200,000 photographs, probably way more.
Oh, my.
Our biggest collections are the Augustana University Archives. That's our largest collection by far. But we also house the historical records for, interestingly enough, for the Episcopal Diocese of South Dakota, and for the South Dakota Conference of the United Church of Christ, and then also the Blue Cloud Abbey archives of their American Indian Culture Research Center. Those are our biggest ones. There are about 100 other organizations that we also work with to preserve their historical records. And some of our strengths are religious history, which ties very much into the focus of our talk today. We also have strengths in nonprofit arts organizations, particularly music organizations. So, for instance, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra archives their records at our location. And then in addition to that, we have over 600 other collections of personal or family papers. So that's where you're getting, like, the collections of letters or diaries or scrapbooks or family histories and interviews and photographs and all that kind of family or personal material. So that then brings us to...
I'm exhausted.
Abby.
I got to tell you, Liz, how do you do this in a 40-hour work week? That is beyond me because it just sounds overwhelming. And I especially had to chuckle because I spent my entire life in the field of journalism. That was my whole professional career. When you said you monitor the student interns, and my heart just went right up in my throat, having monitored student interns myself over the years. So God bless you for all of that that work and stuff. And this is, I mean, it's just fascinating. Again, I'm kind of a history buff. I was darn close to having a minor in history, but a little short. And so all of this you're telling me just takes my breath away, because I have such a respect and a fondness for all of it. So, thank you for sharing all of that, because that is interesting. And again, listeners, you know, if you've been listening from the top of the hour, God bless you and thank you. We appreciate that. On the phone with me from Augustana University in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, is Liz Caesar, and she is the collections assistant at Augustana University. And what prompted this conversation and this Faith in Action show is that I visited there and I saw these two displays about Father Ambrose Mattingly and Father Stan Maudlin, and that prompted me to email Liz and say, hey, would you like to be on the show? Because I think the listeners would appreciate knowing a little bit more about that. And so, wow, you know, what a wonderful information about the archives and the Center for Western Studies and all the aspects of the archival stuff that you keep for other entities. It's, wow, I mean, it is. It's jaw-dropping. So I guess we should segue into maybe Father Ambrose Mattingly at this time, and you could tell the listeners a little bit about him.
Absolutely. So Ambrose Mattingly was born in 1865 in Indiana, so we're talking the same year that the Civil War ended. And he studied at a location in Indiana called St. Meinrad Seminary. And it's a Benedictine seminary, and he actually then entered the Benedictine order in 1886 in his early 20s. And a couple years later, he came out to Dakota Territory to Immaculate Conception Indian Mission, which was at Stefan on the Crow Creek Reservation. The following year, 1889, he was ordained by Bishop Martin Marty in the Little Stefan Chapel. And I have a note here that he was known for his wit and his humor, and he was given the Dakota name Hokshena Peshto, which means sharp boy. And I'll apologize right now. I do have a few Dakota language terms in here. I've never been instructed in the language, so I am taking my best guess at the pronunciation.
Okay.
So I'm hoping I'm not doing a very bad job. But, yes, he was given this nickname, Sharp Boy. He worked there for 30 years in various capacities. He was a painter, a carpenter, a plumber, a farmer, a teacher. He was the principal of the school for some time. He also apparently did some kind of doctor activities. I don't know how that worked exactly, but what that means. But that's what's in the record. In addition to all of these things, he also, very interestingly, operated a photography studio at Stefan at the mission, primarily from 1895 to 1905, so during the turn of the century. And he took a lot of photographs at the studio. He would also take photographs out in front of the post office because they had a porch there. We could get the natural sunlight, and I guess that's the best light he could get. In addition to taking photographs at that mission location, he would also travel and take photos on other reservations. So how we know about this photography interest that he had is that his glass plate negatives were discovered several decades after his death. He died in 1941. His glass plate negatives were discovered at the mission in 1971.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah, and they were brought to Blue Cloud Abbey, which was by that time the base where the Benedictines had built for themselves in South Dakota, up in Marvin, South Dakota. And they were brought to the Abbey for better preservation. Unfortunately, they had already deteriorated quite a bit because of the conditions that they were in. So most recently, from 2002 to 2004, the Abbey partnered with a facility outside of Sioux Falls. It's the USGS Aeros Data Center.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Yes, yes. They partnered with them to have these glass plate negatives scanned at very, very high resolutions and have those scans digitally restored. to try to kind of bring back to life the original photography that he had taken. And then they had prints of these images made for exhibition use. So the display that you're talking about at the Center for Western Studies talks about his life, but also about this process of kind of rescuing these old images.
And what foresight this humble Benedictine priest had. Let's capture this time, this place, these people, you know, so future generations would have a sense of what it was like. Priceless. I mean, who thinks of this stuff? And that's why I found that so remarkable as I was reading about him on the display. I thought, oh my goodness, you know, this guy's a gem. He's a keeper.
And for glass plates to survive,
yes.
That's a specialty situation. I mean, your listeners are probably very familiar with, a lot of them are probably familiar with film photography.
Mm-hmm.
We worked on film for a long time. But before that, it was a piece of glass that was treated chemically, and that was used in the camera system to record the negative. And to try and keep these pieces of glass safe for that long, it's quite a project.
Yeah, very much so. And so that kind of brings us to the other display that I read that I was, again, just blown away, and that's Father Stan Maudlin.
Yes. So Father Stan Maudlin is the guy who is ultimately kind of responsible for a lot of the preservation work involving the glass plate negatives, as well as a whole lot of other materials that we'll talk about. So I'm going to say right here, I have to give credit to a woman named Carol Goss Hoover, who wrote a short biography about Father Stan and presented it at our Dakota Conference event in 1994. And that is what I was able to turn to get a lot more of these details about his life. So I'm going to give her credit for this.
Shout out to Carol. Thank you.
Shout out to Carol. Yes. Father Stan was originally born Irvin James Maudlin, also born in Indiana in 1916. I found his background, so I think we have time. I found his background so interesting. He had an Irish Catholic mother and an English Methodist father.
Gotta love it.
And he talked, apparently, in his oral diary, he talked about growing up as a Catholic kid in a Protestant town where he felt some discrimination, which I think maybe plays into his later role that he played in indigenous relations with the Catholic Church. But also, interestingly enough, his paternal grandfather apparently was a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh.
So how you rectify all of this, I'm not entirely sure, but... he also referenced that he was heavily influenced by his Catholic grandmother, and even to the point where she would often make him drink, he said she would often make him drink a whole glass of holy water before leaving home to protect him. That stuck with him.
You gotta love your Catholic grandmothers, especially
yes.
the Irish ones.
So he also decided to... enter into the ministry. He studied at St. Meinrad, just like Father Ambrose Mattingly did, just several decades later. And while he was there, he actually also officially joined the Benedictine community. And that's when he took the name Stanislaus. He completed his background, so interesting. He completed his studies at St. Meinrad in 1937, and then he actually was allowed to go to Rome to do more advanced studies there. And he, unfortunately, wasn't able to complete his studies because of the alliance made between Hitler and Mussolini. And the U.S. decided they needed to evacuate, and the embassy took the Americans out of the country. But he was there long enough to see, to witness the funeral of Pope Pius XI and then the subsequent coronation of Pope Pius XII.
Wow.
Yeah. So he saw some stuff.
Yeah, he did.
So he comes back to the States, and in 1939, he began what would ultimately be the lifelong experience of mission work among Indigenous people, and he began that at the same place that Mattingly did. He came out also to Immaculate Conception Mission in Stefan at the Crow Creek Reservation.
Wow.
Later assignments would take him to various other locations. He wound up at Marty Mission on the Yankton Reservation in South Dakota for some time. He did longer stints at the mission and also St. Anne's School at Turtle Mountain Reservation, which is in North Dakota. And then he also did quite a number of years at St. Michael's Boarding School on the Fort Totten Indian Reservation in North Dakota, which actually has since been renamed Spirit Lake Reservation. So that's another thing, is keeping track of some of these moving pieces.
Sure.
At these locations, he typically was working in schools, sometimes as teacher, sometimes as an administrator, or he was doing pastor work, because he actually had been ordained in 1942. That is a lot of his in-the-field work. Now, what is interesting is that he was also a founding monk of this place we've been mentioning briefly called Blue Cloud Abbey.
Right.
Which is the abbey that the Benedictines established in 1950 in South Dakota. So the Benedictines had been here since 1876 doing mission work. But they had done that always from St. Meinrad in Indiana as their home base of operations. It wasn't until 1950 that they finally had established like a community space in this area that they could work from.
Mm-hmm.
So they established the abbey in 1950. It took them something like 20 years to build, is my understanding. They did it themselves. And then towards the end of that time period, in the late 1960s, Father Stan decided to establish this organization called the American Indian Culture Research Center at the abbey. And he spent the rest of his life as executive director for this organization. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I do want to also mention, because he has this long list of accomplishments, Father Stan, in addition to all these other things, also became a very prominent leader of the Tekakwitha Conference organization, which was organized over the course of the 20th century for Indigenous Catholics in North America. And he was right there with that organization from the very first meeting in like the 1930s, I believe that happened. In his later life, in 1983, he was appointed Vicar of Indians by the Bishop of the Sioux Falls Diocese in order to act as a liaison between the bishop and his office and the Indigenous community. And he served in that position for 10 years. He passed away in 2006, but based on what we can see, it would appear that one of the things he is most proud of in his lifetime of service to Indigenous cultures in the Dakotas is that he was given, in very special ceremonies, he was given multiple Native American names, which is something that is bestowed on you, you know. And he says that the one he used the most often was his Dakota name, Wamdi Wakasa, which translates to Eagle Man, and that was gifted to him by the Yankton Sioux tribe.
So many commonalities. I mean, here we've got Father Ambrose, Benedictine monk, Father Stan, mm-hmm. Benedictine monk, St. Meinrad, which the Diocese of Sioux City has sent numerous seminarians to study at St. Meinrad in Indiana.
Oh, sure.
You know, that's no surprise. And then you mentioned that Father Ambrose, I think, was ordained by Bishop Marty, well, Mount Marty College in Yankton, South mm-hmm. Dakota. I mean, all of this abuts the Diocese of Sioux City, which, you know, our station is located in Sioux City. So it's just, it's a small world, Liz.
You know,
it
yes,
truly
yes.
is. And then, of course, you mentioned, you know, he spoke and was kind of integral in the Tekakwitha Conference. And St. Kateri Tekakwitha is like, she's wonderful. I mean, we've sent individuals to those conferences. And
oh, sure.
She is just a shining example of what we should all strive to be. So, again, this wonderful commonality of, you know, how we're all kind of entwined with each other and the indigenous people, because they were here and our priests interacted with them and you know, kind of helped them. And now, you know, your Center for Western Studies continues to communicate to to our listeners or to anybody, this huge, rich history that is going on. And that's why I was so blown away by the whole American Indian Culture Research Center, because, again, you house that, because I can't remember when exactly it closed. Was that in the 60s or later?
Well, I can give you, a little brief history about the center. It was founded in the late 1960s, and I was just seeing in my notes about this that it was very much a response to the Second Vatican Council, and specifically changing views towards other religions outside of the Catholic faith. So it was very much coming out of that work in the greater church. And their goal at this American Indian Culture Research Center was kind of twofold. Father Stan wanted to be able to support emerging Indian leaders as they were attempting to rebuild all the institutions that they had lost, that had been taken from them or that had been destroyed. And he defined these things as family, education, law and order, economy, and church. And then his other mission, as far as he was concerned, was to try and help raise up respect among non-Indigenous people for Indigenous spirituality and philosophy of life and culture. And so within that context, they operated what I kind of say it's kind of very similar to the Center for Western Studies in a lot of ways. They maintained a research library of materials about Indigenous cultures that people could come and research in. They kept an extensive photograph collection. They also had an artifact collection that was on display in a public museum space within the Abbey. I still hear people say that they remember going to retreats at the Abbey and seeing the displays of the Native American artifacts. And in addition to that, they would develop or support other projects that would be coming, like being developed on the reservations. So you asked about the closure. So that's kind of what they were doing for all these decades. What happened was, it's not really any fault of the research center, but what happened was, due to a lack of new members entering the Benedictine community at the Abbey, the brothers decided, they voted, they needed to close the Abbey in 2012. And this museum, essentially, had to close too because it was located within the Abbey space. So that's ultimately what happened.
Okay, and that makes sense. I mean, we see this across the board in any religion, not mm-hmm. as many vocations to mm-hmm. The religious life. That's so I'm not surprised. And so then, you know, God bless them for saying, but, you know, we don't want to have a rummage sale or an auction. And so let's give it to someplace. And what better place than the Center for Western Studies, who already has the incredible ability to archive these things and keep them for generations.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the conversation started. The abbot at the time, Abbess Dennis Quinkert, and the woman who was in charge of the research center, her name was Colleen Cordell. She was the executive director after Stan. They knew they wanted to find a place where the collection could stay together and stay in South Dakota. So we entered into a conversation with them because, in addition to just our general ability to do that, we had this longstanding relationship with Father Stan, or we had until his passing. He had been a member of our first board of directors in the 70s, and he later served on our National Advisory Council, which advises the Center for Western Studies. And he also had decided in the mid-'80s to start archiving his files as the executive director in our building. So he was still very much in charge of this research center, but we were actually actively archiving his files for him, his professional files. And we did that. He was depositing things for 20 years until his death. So we have like nearly 40 boxes of his files as the director of this institution. So we had worked with him all those decades, and we, like you said, we had the ability and we had the space to accept these collections. So that was kind of how the decision was made. I was here when this happened, and it was quite the whirlwind because it was the single largest acquisition we'd ever received in the Center for Western Studies history. It came with nearly 1,100 artifacts. There were 150 artworks. Library materials, there was 4,600 books that came out of their library. And we were very, let me put it this way, we also have been interested in Native cultures in this region for some time and have collected our own library of materials. So we were very happy when we realized how much of it was the items that were duplicates of maybe things we already had. We were glad to share those duplicates out with other institutions. So several went to some of the community tribal colleges. We sent some to Crazy Horse Memorial Library. Some went to the South Dakota State Penitentiary Library to help build up their collections. So that was great that we were given the opportunity to do that. But then in addition to these items, the biggest part of the collection by far was their photography collection, which I estimate is something like 85,000 images across multiple formats. Yes. Yes.
My goodness.
It's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And the images span the years 1870 to 2004, so several decades. And they really they document the missionary work of that community of Benedictine monks in the Dakotas. And they document their work among the Native American populations and particularly in the areas of church life and in also in relation to the boarding schools that they operated, the Native American boarding schools.
Wow. That just takes my breath away. Mm-hmm. And now, listeners, honestly, if you make the decision that you want to go up to the Center for Western Studies, trust me, all 85,000 pictures are not on display, but there are some. But again, it just shows the foresight of Father Ambrose and Father Stan to capture these moments. Priceless. Mm-hmm. I mean, that these two men thought about this. And, of course, we think of Benedictine monks as kind of humble and quiet. And here they, for some reason, the Holy Spirit moved them to do this. And now, you know, you folks have it for generations if someone wants to study it.
Yes.
So that in itself is remarkable. And then you do have stuff on display that are related to Father Ambrose and Father Stan and, of course, the American Indian Cultural Research Center, because I saw some of those. But I guess, Liz, you know, we're kind of coming to the point in the show where we're winding things down. And I know my listeners, and they have pens and pencils and paper. And so they're going to write this down as to where exactly is the Center for Western Studies.
Yeah. So we are on the Augustana University campus. If you want to put our address into Google Maps, the address you want to use is 2121 South Summit Avenue. And that will bring you right to our building. Our building, the way I describe it when people are unfamiliar with campus, is you're going to come into the parking lot and you're going to see the building with the gigantic two-story teepee made of glass windows.
Yes.
That is the front of our building. That's us.
And that's what we did. We put it into Google Maps and we pulled up and we went, I think we're here.
Yes.
So how about days and times of when you folks are open to the public?
Yes. So we are open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. We are closed for major holidays following the university's schedule. And I always tell people the best way to follow any holiday closures or like weather closures. Because we're in South Dakota.
Welcome to the Midwest.
is to follow our Facebook or our Twitter, our Twitter feeds, because that's where we'll keep that up-to-date information. And we absolutely invite people to come. It's free admission into the museum. If, for some reason, you're not able to come to our facility, I would point out that we do have some materials from the Blue Cloud Abbey collection available online to view as part of our digital collections. And the address for that is np3.augie.edu.
Okay.
So np3.augie.edu. And you would see on there, you would see photographs of about half of the artifacts that we received as part of the collection. We've also put up a sampling of photos from the image collection, and some of those, again, relate to boarding school history, which is a topic of great interest.
And then, listeners, we will also have on our website, SiouxLandCatholicRadio.com, pictures that Liz is going to send us so that we can share with you when this program airs, and you can click on Faith in Action, and there will be some pictures there as well, just to kind of reinforce everything. So, again, what a wonderful interview and conversation this has been. Elizabeth Cesar, she is Collections Assistant at the Center for Western Studies, which is located on the Augustana University campus in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Liz, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat with me. I'm very grateful.
Oh, thank you.
And again, listeners, thank you for listening. And a shout out once more to Mary's Choice that makes this program possible. They are our primary underwriters. They are a pregnancy resource center here in Sioux City, and we are grateful for their support. So that brings us to an end of Faith in Action. So on behalf of myself, Joanne Fox, and my executive producer, Ann Reed, I want to remind you that a faithful reaction is good, but faith in action is so much better. Thanks for listening, and God bless.